Good morning, everybody, and welcome to our actually second meeting of the House State Affairs Committee. We had our first committee meeting in 2008 up in Anchorage. We considered the Alaska Land Mobile Radio System, which was a good presentation. But this is the first actual State Affairs Committee meeting to be held during the second session of the 25th Legislature. I'd like to wish everybody a Happy New Year, and we'll do that by trying to get this committee off to a good start. I'll do a roll call now. We have with us this morning my Vice Chair, Representative Bob Roses, Representative, what's your name down there? Representative Johnson, Representative Coghill. And I believe Representative Gruenberg has been excused for this morning's proceeding. And joining us is Representative Andrea Dahl. Welcome, please. We have many, many bills to be considered this year, the entire legislature, and the State Affairs Committee has many bills. We do have a 90-day session. It is my intent to move bills as rapidly as we can, but only after thorough consideration and especially public testimony. Insofar as possible, insofar as practical, I'm going to put ethics-related bills at the kind of the head of the line, because I think that's very, very important. We have to continue building the foundation of trust between the good people of Alaska and those who elect their folks to public office. And with that in mind, we're going to begin this session and this committee meeting with HB 281. And HB 281 is an act extending the statute of limitations for filing of complaints with Alaska Public Offices Commission, known lovingly as APOC, involving state election campaigns. And I think this is a bill whose time has come, and I'm going to ask my staffer, Mike Seeker, to explain the details of this bill and why we think we ought to pass this bill. And if possible, I would like to move this bill out of committee today. So, Mr. Seeker, are you ready for us?
Yes.
And just we will have on the line Brooke Miles from APOC, Jan DeYoung from the Department of Law, and Steve Clary from ACPR. Morning, Michael. State your name for the record, please.
Good morning. My name is Mike Seeker. I'm a staffer for Representative Lynn. And this bill will be the first egg in the 2008 State Affairs frying pan, so I hope it's edible. So I'll just start off by getting right into the bill itself. Real simply, it just is going to extend the statute of limitations on campaign finance complaints from 1 year to 5 years. And don't have a lot to say. I'll go over a brief outline. Like Chairman Lynn said, we have Brooke Miles from the Alaska Public Offices Commission online, and she can answer a lot of your specific questions.
And I would like to recognize that Representative Johansson has joined us.
Good afternoon, Colin.
As the sponsor of this bill, Representative Lynn feels that the longer time limit on the statute of limitations will better serve lawmakers, candidates, the state, and the public. It makes the investigation more credible. It gives people confidence in the process, and I think it's more fair to everyone, including the lawmakers themselves. There's nothing worse than reading that, oh, by the way, this popped up 1 year, 2 year, 3 years later, but we're past the statute. You can't help but cringe. And the chances are someone has probably done nothing wrong. And when there are, you know, you hear the words complaints, investigations, and violations, they sound like negative terms. It's just mistakes, and most of them are unintentional. It's like watching a football game and someone throws a flag. It's a 5-yard penalty. Nobody intended to do that. There are cases where you'll have someone that has intended to violate it, but hopefully and thankfully they're few and far between. Since 2003, when we reduced the statute of limitations from 4 years to one, we've had some events happen, particularly in the past year, that I think shows the need to go back to at least 4 years, and that's what the Alaska Public Offices Commission recommended. And I'll just give a brief history of where our statute came from. I spoke with people at APOC, and they said, I think it was in 1986 or so, they picked 4 years because that was considered the norm on civil violations that are tied to the election cycle of the longest term of our state lawmakers. In this case, it's senators, it's the governor, it's the lieutenant governor. Again, it was changed in 2003 from 4 years to 1 year. And I've spoken from everyone, to people at AIPAC, to people in the former administration. Depending on who you speak to, the reason for that is everything from they wanted to streamline the process, they wanted to save money, to why not incorporate AIPAC into the Attorney General's office where there's more teeth for us to enforce this. Well, what happened was we ended up with, I feel, maybe a combination of the worst, a one-year statute of limitation under the auspices of AIPAC, which has limited funding. So I think that's where we are today. And what happens is it looks like the people are running out the clock when that's, in fact, not what's happening. The reason why we decided to go with 5 years was if we're going to fix it or tweak it, let's say, rather than have 4 years, why not have 5 years? If your maximum term is 4 years and you can campaign as far out as 18 months before you're seated, that really is 5.5 years. So it really, if we're going to cover the period, let's legitimately cover it. And I think most of the people I've seen here in the last two sessions are honest, hardworking people who are happy to be held accountable. And I think it just will reflect well on all of us. The other thing I wanted to talk about is, despite the change in the statute of limitations, we still have what's called, you know, what Brooke explained to me was the expedited adjudication process. From the time we go in, or AIPAC goes in, and a violation is, they decide to invest a violation to the time that investigation is completed, it still is basically 60 days. That's not going to change. So you still have that speedy process, which again serves lawmakers as well as the public. Okay. Briefly, if you look in your packet, you can see what other states do. From what I could gather and the research we have, it ranges from no statute of limitation to 5 years. Many of them are 1 or 2 years. Georgia, for example, has 3 years for 2-year terms and 5 years for 4-year terms. Washington has 5 years. Many states have shorter statutes of limitations, but they don't start until the discovery of a violation as opposed to the time the violation was committed. That could be an endless process. And I added something to your packet after talking with Joyce Anderson from the Select Committee on Ethics. Many states have a combination of what I think are two good things. They have a longer statute of limitation, plus they have a clause that's similar to Section 2460-170 in our legislative ethics code, which basically the Select Committee on Ethics has a 2-year statute of limitation. However, and it says it right here, the time limitations of this subsection do not bar proceedings against the person who intentionally prevents discovery of a violation of this chapter. So in a sense, if it's not one of these unintentional, innocent mistakes, I know that sounds like an oxymoron, you shouldn't be rewarded for your ability to prevent that. That is not in this bill right now. It's just it's an interesting point we came across after filing it, and it's something you may want to consider. Finally, you have the fiscal note there. I think it's $156,000, and I wanted to address that briefly. In 2003, when they reduced the statute of limitations from 4 years to one, they saved money. They took away the resources that would enable them to do the proper investigations that should have taken place under 4 years. If we're going to, and Representative Lynn believes this, rightly give them enough time to conduct a credible investigation, we should also give them the resources to conduct that. And the last thing I have to say is most of the people at this table and this committee work so hard on strengthening our ethics laws, and it's a growing process as you're learning in your ethics workshops. And we're learning that we have to tweak it. We have to loosen some things and tighten some things. We have to allow for compassionate gift giving. We have to allow spouses to get gifts. These are areas where it's reasonable to loosen the screws on certain areas of the law. And this is an area where I think we need to tighten them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, consideration. Any questions for Mike Seeker? My goodness. Would you still be available to
yes.
answer questions? I'm going to ask Brooke Miles. Are you available?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. This is Brooke Miles.
Good morning, Brooke. And before we go any further, Brooke, I want to thank you for your long and dedicated public service. Information to everybody who's watching or listening. She retires, I think it was March 6th, is it? And you've been in, you've not been part of this committee, but you've been kind of ex officio part of this committee. I want to thank you for your long and dedicated service. So, Brooke, please introduce yourself officially. And
thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brooke Miles, and I am the Executive Director for the Alaska Public Offices Commission. And, Mr. Chairman, thank you for hearing this bill this morning and moving so expeditiously on an area of law that has the Commission's full support, as all the members of your committee are aware. Under recent developments, it has become apparent that a one-year statute of limitations does not provide the Commission sufficient tools to respond to the public's concerns regarding violations of the laws that we administer. The Commission does support this legislation and did request an expansion of the statute of limitations under our laws from 1 year to 4 years. That being said, I am certain that the Commission will have no issue whatsoever with that increase to a 5-year statute of limitation. And, Mr. Chairman, when I met with you, thank you very much for doing that, by the way, and your staff member to discuss the provisions of this bill, and we talked about the practicality, in fact, of a 5-year statute of limitations, because it would encapsulate the first reporting required of a candidate who, as Mr. Seeker reported, could begin her campaign 18 months before the date of the election. So it would capture all of that is required to be reported if a person wanted to, if a member of the public saw a concern and filed a complaint with this commission. Mr. Chairman, the Commission worked with the Department of Law after determining that we were interested in requesting an expansion of the statute of limitations, and there is there are a couple of suggestions that we would make. One being that we codify specifically in each of the laws that the Commission administers, not only the campaign disclosure law, AS 1513, but also the regulation of lobbying law, that's AS 2445, the financial disclosure for legislators, and that's AS 2460, 200 through 260, and financial disclosure for executive branch and municipal officials and candidates, that's in AS 3950. We would request a 5-year statute of limitations under each one of those laws. In addition to that, so that the Commission would be able to do its work in investigating complaints under these laws, we would request also that the statutory requirement for retention of records, both at this agency and by the filer, be expanded to cover the statute of limitations plus 1 year, which would be a 6-year retention of records. Mr. Chairman, the Commission has placed a fiscal note on this because in addition to the tools for responding to the public's concerns regarding violations of Alaska's disclosure laws, the Commission would need the resources to make sure that we could expeditiously and competently conduct these investigations within the time required. The costs that are included in the fiscal note, Mr. Chairman, are for an investigator position and a paralegal, and they would be dedicated to this area of enforcement with respect to the disclosure laws. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony this morning for the committee, and I am looking forward to answering any questions.
I'd like to thank you very much for your clear explanation of your take on this bill. Any questions for Brooke Miles, Representative Johansson?
Do you have a increment in the operating budget for your commission?
The commission did ask for an increment in the budget amendments, which hasn't come to, I don't think I haven't come to you yet. And that increment includes some additional funding in contractual services that would just, and it relates to FY09, that to cover shortfalls, you know, in such a transitionary period, it was difficult for us to identify specifically without any recommendations of changing statutes at that time before us where we would need funding, and we did put in an increment request in contractual services.
Go ahead. Representative Johansson?
Did you have an increase in last year's budget over the prior year?
Yes, we did. And as you recall, the increase in last year's operating budget was to restore the single investigator position that APOC now has.
I noticed this doesn't go to finance. It has a fiscal note, so this is why I'm asking financial questions at State Affairs. I don't mean to get outside of our jurisdiction, but we will have the subcommittee as I sit on administration. I know these will reconcile as it goes through the process, and I don't want to ask that a finance referral be added or belabor it, but I think it's important to keep track of all of the different increments through fiscal notes and the operating budget. With our operating budget skyrocketing every single year. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Coghill.
Just for what it's worth, because it does have a fiscal impact, it will go to Finance Committee. It will go to Finance Committee. Mr. Chairman, a couple questions.
Yes.
Brooke, thank you for your testimony. I guess the question I have in my mind is, two positions. Is there enough work? Is there enough volume of complaints to keep two people continuously working on just alleged violations?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, when the investigator and the junior investigator under this request and paralegal are not working directly on an investigation that has been filed by a member of the public or by this commission staff, then they will be working on the other enforcement arm, that being the careful auditing of the documents that are filed with our commission and requests for additional information where required, and things of that nature.
Mr. Chairman, and then the last question, and thank you, Brooke, I appreciate that. The other thing is, as we enter into the electronic filing world, do we anticipate that that would be less labor-intensive?
That has always been a goal, and that was, of course, one of the foundation pieces of the consideration to get more modern, have an electronic library, and have electronic filing. That being said, it has always been our consideration that once that system is up and running, that this agency itself will look at the funding, the reallocation of staff resources, and in all hope be able to identify efficiencies that may well result in future budget reductions.
Yeah, we all hope that, and so thank you. I do suppose, though, that as we get more and more into the electronic filing world, that being able to draw up records quickly for these alleged violations probably will be better. So just that's the world we're living in. We're getting better as we go, probably. So thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Dollar, do you have a question? Comment?
Just a comment.
Please.
No, I thank you for the work on this, and you know, with our emphasis on ethics, I think we can't really talk about this whole subject without having you all well funded and staffed, and otherwise it's sort of an empty talk. So I appreciate this bill coming forward.
Representative Coghill?
I think the comment that she made on referencing Titles 24 under Section 44 and 62 and then Title 39 under Section 50 are important, though. And I noticed on our paper, on our desk here, a paper dealing with 246170. Mr. Chairman, I agree. I think if we're going to do this, we should look at those sections as a unit. And I hadn't anticipated that. I figured we were just going to go ahead and see this as a simple fix, and I agree
nothing
with it, pass it on. But on Brooke's suggestion, I wouldn't mind including in the scope of this bill those statutory references if need be. And so, you know, have you, as a chairman or as a bill sponsor, have you considered that up to this point?
No, we have not considered that at this point. I think, Michael, did you have a comment?
Thank you for bringing that, Representative. Yes, so when Brooke came and met with us, we went over this, and it looks like something that we could include in this and would like to, and that's why we had her raise that as well as this section that Joyce Anderson had mentioned and showed up here in case you wanted her to explain how it works. On
would we need to expand the title?
Maybe because we go outside of the APOC. But if we go into the ethics title, maybe, but I don't anticipate that. That would be a drafter's choice, I think.
I don't think so.
But I think since it was proven to me last time we did the ethics bill that it was better to look at all the bills in a unit rather than in different sections because of the unintended consequence of a misfit. So if we're going to deal with the statute of limitations, and there might be good reasons why in the APOC it works well, but in ethics it may not work so well, mm-hmm. or we may actually want to consider longer or shorter times because of the way a campaign season goes over against how we're reporting once we have to leave office. We have to report within 90 days. And so I think it might be worth looking at these three different titles in their statute of limitations. So just
and that would include the keeping of records?
Yes. In fact, I think in my basement are all 11 years of my records, and I've kept them partly as memorabilia, partly too lazy to throw away, but the idea of I didn't even consider the statute of limitations, but I kept them for my own records. I think that's wise, keeping records. So
depending on the record.
Yeah, and the more we get into electronic, if you can just download them onto a disk, you know, it's not that big a deal. But I would ask that maybe we work on getting those sections together, or maybe drafting. I'd be willing to sit down and work with you on that to make sure that we're looking at all the statutes affected by statute of limitations.
Okay, and I would certainly consider that. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess this is a question you as much. We're looking at adding an administration and lobbyist to the statute of limitations. I think that's what I heard.
That was the suggestion, and whether they fit or not, I don't know.
They wouldn't, because I think of the election part of it, but that's my question to Brooke then is, we're basically going to double the number of people, and I'm just guessing 100 lobbyists and however many administration people, and you have a fiscal note that adds an investigator and another person. Are we looking, if we do that, are we looking at an additional fiscal note to give you the staff to do double the work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, no, that would not increase the fiscal note. Under the way the Public Offices Commission is structured, a citizen or the commission staff can file a complaint under any of the four disclosure laws that we administer, not just the campaign disclosure law. And, for example, with respect to the lobbying law, you know, there are actually over 200 lobbyists, and I think over 300, there are 500 employers, and, you know, doing some $20 million worth of business these days in our state. For example, and then the other one is the financial disclosure. Now, you file a financial disclosure statement, and because of changes that you made to the laws last year, those in the executive branch and candidates file a financial disclosure statement that is substantially the same as yours. And as you know, that includes a large degree of personal financial information regarding officials' sources of income and their indebtedness. Oh. Anyway, because it would not increase the fiscal note. We still have people filing complaints under the other laws, whether or not we expand the statute of limitations under each of them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I guess I'm a little puzzled. If you can handle twice as many, or if it works out maybe five times as many people with the same money in this fiscal note, why can't you handle the amount of people that we're talking about adding without the fiscal note that we had before us? If you can double your work for the same money, why can't you do the same work for the same money now? I mean, it's considerably more work when we add the administration and the lobbyists, yet it doesn't cost anything yet to add the 60 or 120 of us. It's costing $170,000. I'm a little puzzled as how you can work that magic.
Well, currently, with one investigator, it is not always possible to meet our statutorily placed deadline of 60 days to conclude a complaint, even if it's an allegation of a violation that occurred in the past 12 months, which is what we're restricted to now across all of our laws. An allegation is regarding a violation that occurred some years back, say, for example, 4 years back, it's generally more complex to investigate. It's more difficult to find evidence and to interview witnesses just because of the time elapsed from that time of the complaint to the alleged violation to the date that the complaint was filed, which is why we put in the fiscal note. So whether it's only on AS 1513 or it's on all of them, it would be the same amount. This would cover it.
Follow up?
So if we don't add the administration, we pass this as is, then they will be doing less work, so we could reduce this fiscal note?
If you don't expand the statute of limitations and you don't give us any funding, things will stay the way they are.
I said reduce, not. I mean, if you can take this fiscal note and double the work with it, could we cut it in half and have you do the same work that you're doing, including just the legislative and the elected officials?
Probably not effectively.
Math doesn't work for me, Mr. Chairman, but I'll deal with that later.
I had two questions. So any of the cases that you have had or any of the complaints that have been brought forward that were not heard because of the statute of limitations that expired after the 1 year, will that now reopen all of those?
Mr. Chairman, it is my understanding that no, it will not reopen old cases. Complaints that were filed and alleged facts that were beyond the statute of limitations at that time, that because of the construction of statutes, when you make the change, we can't go back and reactivate that complaint.
Okay. Just wanted that for the record. The second question that I had is earlier when the question was asked, do we have that many complaints that would warrant another legal person and a paralegal to deal with this, and the statement was we don't anticipate it, and if they weren't working on complaints, they would be then reviewing the documents and the disclosure forms. Well, all those disclosure forms have to be filed now, so who's reviewing them now? Or are they not being reviewed?
They receive only the most cursory review as they are entered into a database and put away in files.
OK. Okay, so I guess the answer to the question was they're being reviewed, but not with the in-depth that you would like to see them reviewed. In this.
Not the way the public expects us to review them, that's correct. And that's simply because of lack of resources.
Mr. Chair, if I may, it appears that we have some more work that we need to do on this bill, and I certainly think it would be in the best interest of this committee if we set this aside until such time as we looked at the possibility of having this amended to include those other sections of statute.
I would agree with that. I'd like to continue, though, the discussion at this point. But I think information we heard is good. The suggestions may be good. I would like to look at this further and hear it as soon as possible as we can after this. Representative Johansson.
Yeah, no, apologize in advance, but it's kind of a pet peeve of mine that, you know, over the years that I've worked in the building on the different budgets, we've had leaps and bounds in technology. And when the rules chairman talked about efficiencies from things like having the online electric filing, where you just go in there and it's automatically put into a database. The director just mentioned that the people that are working on that now basically are doing data entry, and that has to be a time-consuming exercise. And what I've seen in the past, you know, we've had people come up in front of subcommittees and request technology, request computer programs and hardware and such, and it's always, the question is always, will that make you more efficient? Will that be able to let you get your job done, the job that you're assigned to do? Because usually the justification is we need this technology so we can get our job done. Well, it seems like what happens is you're more efficient, yet more things are added to your checklist. Suddenly your job is not this anymore, it's this plus this plus this. And I really like to focus, if we're going to invest money in the technology and in the computer programs and all such that makes this job that you're assigned to do easier or more efficient, rather than add more items to your to-do list, maybe we should rein back the cost of government rather than just keep adding things on. If you got people doing data entry on all of these public disclosures that we have to do, mine is very thin because I've got a house and a car. That's about it. Some people have all kinds of investments and properties. I've seen them this thick before. You know, that has to take days for these people to go through all of this stuff and put it in there.
And the possibility of an error when you enter the data.
Sure. And, you know, if we have the same person who's spending hours a day doing data entry, when they should be going over the actual information and checking it, as she said, they want them to go and they're doing a cursory investigation or checking of all the information rather than sitting there at a computer and entering data, you know, that technology would allow them, the same person, rather than adding another person or another two people, you know, that person now would be free, as the rules chairman mentioned, to use that time to actually do the job that they're supposed to be doing. And, you know, hopefully I'm around long enough to sit there on the subcommittee next year and the year after and find out if that's actually happening. But what my experience in the past is that doesn't happen, is we just add more things to the person to do, and then they do three half jobs rather than one full job well. And that's how we end up with more people being hired to do more jobs, and the budget keeps ballooning. So I think we need to keep a close eye on this stuff.
Thank you. Any other questions? Oh, yes. Representative Dahl.
Well, I think you have a good point, but I see that who she wants to hire is a paralegal. Paralegal and an investigator, and I don't see that as people that are just doing data entry. Hopefully, the data entry people are there, and they're at a lower budget item than what she's asking. Clearly, we need people who analyze, and that's something that we don't have and haven't had. So,
right, we are getting a little far afield from the title of the bill here, which was to extend statute of limitations, but that's okay because, you know, we were looking at the entire ethics situation and not just pieces of it. So we are a little beyond the intent of this bill, but I'm prepared to go there. That's where the committee wants to go. Any other questions for Brooke Miles?
I don't have a question. I have a comment.
Okay.
A statement was made that the public expects us to go into great detail on this investigation of disclosure forms, and that I would happen to probably have some disagreement with. As a landlord, I don't think the public expects to know exactly the name of every person that rents an apartment from you. If I own 15 apartments, I don't think the public expects to know who all 15 of those people are, but that's required on a disclosure form. There's lots of other things. What the public does expect is that their elected officials are representing the best interests of everybody in the state of Alaska and not just a particular group or a particular company or a particular individual with whom that elected official may have some financial connection. But the kind of detail that's required in our disclosure forms and the kind of scrutiny that some people like to give it, a prudent legislator is going to err on the side of caution, report way more than you possibly have to. And I can tell you, if you want to take a look at my financial disclosure form, go ahead, because there's a limit to the dollar amount as to how much you're supposed to report. I don't take any chances, because I know there are individuals out there that love to take fair game at anybody that gets elected and look for anything they can find. And so you'll find on my financial disclosure statement the reporting of every free airline ticket that I get for cashing in miles, because I don't take a chance. And are you telling me that the public expects that kind of scrutiny? No, they don't. They want their people to be ethical, they want to be honest, and they want them to be working on behalf of everybody in the state, not an individual or another company. That's the kind of stuff that the public want. They don't expect the kind of scrutiny that I think that these forms require.
Mr. Chairman. One of the things we learned in ethics training yesterday is that it's better to over-disclose than undisclose, and that's exactly what you said, although I would point out that to the best of my knowledge, landlords are not elected officials, and they don't campaign for the job.
No, but if I am, I'm the landlord.
Did you get elected, sir?
Last time I checked.
Okay. Representative Coggio.
Thank you.
I'm just joshing.
And this will go to Brooke. And I understand the resource problem of just trying to do everything. Brooke, let me ask you a question that I hope I can get it out right. Number one, on noticing something out of place or out of line from the commission's perspective, whether it's the executive director or a member of the commission, the way it's strictly read here, we would expect a complaint to come forward. What has been the policy of the executive director and the commission as far as calling those so affected, for example, me, if I file a disclosure that was out of line? Because I think you probably, be my guess, you look for those things that are out of the ordinary. Would you anticipate filing a complaint first, or would you contact the person to check it out first? So I just your policy on that first. And then secondly, how many complaints come to you from outside the commission that would cause you to, say, open up a file and begin to scrutinizing it on a, I guess you could probably describe the scope of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to Representative Coghill. That's a really good question, because when I talked about the auditing procedures, they would not, of course, always result in a staff-initiated complaint. In fact, it's most likely been over a decade since the staff initiated a complaint. Speaking in terms of election cycles, which is certainly when we receive the most complaint activity, although complaints have been filed, in fact, in 2007, almost all of our complaints were with respect to the financial disclosure laws. Most of our complaints are filed usually regarding the campaign disclosure law, and we also get complaints filed under the lobbying law as well. That being said, it's difficult to really give you an average of the number of complaints. You know, during the 2004 election cycle, the 2002 election cycle, I believe we had 27 complaints. During the 2004 election cycle, it was many, many less, perhaps 12 complaints. And last year, I think, or the 2006 election cycle, I think, was more like 8 complaints. And so, you know, they work at different levels. That being said, with respect to the auditing process, usually what we do in the beginning is certainly not determining. It would have to be some, you know, the documents on its face would have to show some obvious and clear, significant violation of law for us to go forward with a staff-initiated complaint at that point. Our first contact would be to the filer to identify what we saw as missing or we saw as inconsistent and asking for clarification from the filer. Now, sometimes that could result in an enforcement action such as the levying of a civil penalty because something substantial was left off of a report. But it would not fall that we would automatically begin and conduct a staff-initiated complaint. However, you're also right in that our agency is complaint-driven with respect to its investigations. So once a formal investigation is commenced, you know, this agency needs to make clear to the respondent what is being alleged and, of course, offer the respondent their full right of due process of law to state their side and participate in the process there with full participation.
Thank you very much. And I wanted to show that clarification because it's been my experience that that's been true, that whenever I have left something off or put something in the wrong place or, heaven forbid, that I actually put wrong information down, which I've done, and had to go back and square it away, that they've contacted me, and so I appreciate that. And with regard to the statute of limitations, whether that workload would go up or not, I suppose is we could conjecture that. But based on the complaint load, I just don't know that it would. And I guess my question then was, would we anticipate staff-directed complaints? And it sounds to me like it's just a matter of course if we have a something wrong, then if it's blatant, then it would be a complaint driven. If it's inadvertent, then it would be they would be proactive in talking to the filer. So I guess I'm okay with it.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Miles? Again, Brooke, I'd like to thank you for your testifying this morning and your suggestions. I think they're good suggestions, and we are going to look at that. And we'll. I don't believe we'll pass this out of committee today. We're going to look at this and come back to it. But while we're here, I would like to continue with those people who are signed up to testify. Steve Clary, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, you're just fine. Thank you for coming in this morning or to testify. Please state your name and organization and give us your take on all this.
Thank you very much. My name is Steve Clary. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, ACPIRG. ACPIRG's been in Alaska for over 30 years. We've got about 1,500 members across the state, and we work to protect consumers and make sure that government's responsive to citizens at all levels. Happy to be here today in support of HB 281. We've long advocated for stronger tools and stronger enforcement by the Alaska Public Offices Commission, and we see this as one tool that they could use to restore the public trust in Alaska's elected officials. There was just a story I read in the paper this week on a complaint filed against a legislator, and that was the complaint was dismissed, but also in the story it said that the statute of limitations had also run out, and that led me as you all could probably guess, as somewhat of a skeptical person, to think that, oh, maybe that person was hiding something. But on the flip side, and I think more of what a legislator's point of view would be something similar to what Mr. Sika expressed earlier, that could put a cloud over somebody who didn't do anything wrong, but simply the fact that the statute of limitations had run out might make that a person appear guilty when they actually didn't do anything. So either one of those would be good reasons to extend the statute of limitations, but both together are definitely both good reasons to extend it, to make sure that legislators aren't impugned if they didn't do anything wrong, but also to give AIPOC the ability to investigate cases that they should investigate. And so I think this is a great first step in giving AIPOC more tools, and the further investigators and the price that that may cost seems to be a small, very small investment in making sure that legislators are accountable and that they are filing and acting accordingly. So I thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and we're in full support of HB 281. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate you indicating that things like this do have flip sides on it. One, to hold elected officials accountable, and number two, that did not have a chance to defend himself and not impugned falsely. So I think that is good. We do have to protect the process. Any questions for Mr. Ackberg?
Not to Clary.
Not Mr. Ackberg. Well, actually, Steve, I think of you, Mr. Ackberg.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
But I think that's a compliment rather than anything else. So thank you, Steve. Okay, we have Jan DeLine. Jan, I can't talk this morning. Jan DeYoung online for questions only. Anybody have any questions? She's with the Department of Law. If not, thank you for being available, Ms. DeYoung.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any other comments from Mr. Seeger?
Thank you.
Okay, that's a good comment. But with that, we're going to set this aside. I want to bring it back to the committee as soon as we possibly can to move the process along. And after we adjourn, we'll some of us get together and look at this in concert with all the folks involved here. So thank you very much, everybody who came in to testify on it. I think this is a good bill. We're going to try to make it better. Okay, next bill we're going to consider is HB 260, State Officers Compensation Commission. We'll take a short at ease here. I'd like to call the House State Affairs Committee back from recess, and I'd like to welcome Representative Mike Dugan in the hot seat there. We're going to be considering House Bill 260, the title of which is an act relating to State Officers Compensation Commission and establishing how legislators, the governor, lieutenant governor, and executive department heads shall be compensated, provided for an effective date by repealing the effective dates of certain sections of 124 SLA 1986 and providing for an effective date. So again, will you put that back in English for us and tell us what kind of bill you have here?
I'll do my best, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we ought to pass it, maybe.
Thank you very much. And thanks to the committee for taking the time to hear this bill. I'm Mike Dugan. For the purposes of this discussion, I think you can think of me as Representative Spinard. I represent House District 25 in Anchorage.
You're not Representative Spinard like I had poor Steve Clary and Mr. Hackberg.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, Mr. Chairman. Essentially, what House Bill 260 would do is to bring back into being a salary commission that existed in 1977 through 1979. This was long enough ago that I was actually a young staffer in this building when the salary commission was in existence. And we have in the audience Senator Kim Elton, who was a public member of that commission, who I've asked to be here to tell you a little bit about what they did and how they went about doing it. There was an attempt to reestablish the commission in the mid-1980s, which failed primarily because, for reasons that aren't entirely clear to me reading the record, the commission was tied to a constitutional amendment which was never offered, let alone passed. And part of the repealer language that you read in the title takes that those provisions out of the law, which I think are essentially the only repealers in there. The commission would be five public members. One member would be appointed from a list presented, they're all appointed by the governor. They don't require legislative confirmation. One member would be appointed from a list provided by the president of the Senate, one from a list provided by the Speaker of the House. The other three would be public members. They would serve staggered terms. There isn't really very much detail as their duties would be to review the compensation of the principal, the legislators and the principal officers of the state of Alaska, and they'd be required to essentially publish findings at least every two years. Beyond that, this is not a very prescriptive bill. It leaves to the good sense of the citizens who are appointed exactly how they would do their job. And it is, frankly, an attempt to basically cut us out of the action as much as possible. It's my personal belief that it's very difficult to have an even-handed examination of compensation that includes legislators' compensation if it's the legislature that's doing it. Their recommendations would become law if they weren't specifically disapproved by the legislature within a 60-day period of their presentation. The legislature keeps essentially final authority by the fact that nothing that they recommend would be funded without legislative appropriation. So I think that's it. There's a $7,500 fiscal note on it. We have a couple of people from the Department of Administration in the audience if you need somebody to talk about the fiscal note. In addition to Senator Elton, we've asked a gentleman named Carl Kurtz from the National Council of State Legislators to be online to tell us a little bit about similar compensation commissions in other states and about legislative compensation in other states. And with that, I'll be happy to try to answer.
You'd have five members, correct?
Yes.
And one of whom would be appointed by the Speaker, one by the President of the Senate. Would those members be voting members of the Commission or just make recommendations for other people to vote on?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. They wouldn't actually be appointed by the presiding officers. The bill contemplates that each presiding officer would send to the governor two names, and the governor would make the appointment from that list. They would both be voting members. The idea behind that is to try to make sure that there are some people who are conversant enough with particularly the powers and duties of the legislature, but also of the administration to be able to provide, extra information and counsel to the other members on questions that inevitably are going to arise about, office accounts and things like that.
Yeah, it seems to me that they could provide valuable information, as you said, but could it put them in an untenable position if they recommended something when next time they go up for re-election?
No, they're not.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Perhaps I didn't make it clear. It's not the bill does not say that they have to be members of the legislature.
Oh,
simply
okay.
That they have to be nominated by the presiding officers, and frankly. It would be up to the presiding officer.
Anybody within the state.
And I think that our current presiding officers are canny enough not to try to put legislators in those positions.
Representative Roses.
Unless I'm reading this incorrectly, on page 3, line 13, section 3923.510, doesn't that prohibit a state employee? So the presiding officers wouldn't be appointing somebody from the body.
Right.
It would have to be someone that is not a serving legislator.
Yeah. If I might, Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative Roses. It was my intention when having this drafted to not put legislators in the position that we find ourselves in now, in which we're essentially the arbiters of our own compensation. It's a system which has got problems all around, I think is a fair way to describe it. And in going back to look at what we might do, I found this compensation commission to be the best example. It's the last thing we've had that actually worked. And so it seemed to me that what we ought to do is try to replicate that and hope that it works again.
Your follow-up?
Please.
Representative Rogers?
In that same section, under Section B, which would be line 18 on page 3 of the bill, it says a member of the commission may not have served in an officer position. So it is the intent that a former legislator would not then be able to serve on this, which would then give you some institutional history, because they certainly aren't giving themselves a raise when they're no longer in that position. But this bill would prohibit somebody from serving on the commission if they are considering compensation for the position which they used to hold, not what they currently hold.
The language does exactly what you say it does, Representative Brewer.
And I guess the question is, do we really want that?
That's really a matter for the committee. It's written that way in an attempt to put this at as an extreme and arm's length from the elected officials who will be affected as possible. If the committee thinks that it would be a better idea to allow former legislators or former governors, I suppose, to be members, that's fine with me.
Maybe only after one of these people have been out of office for a period of time, maybe 2, 4, 5 years or something.
Right.
So they're not the immediate connection.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I might, my concern was that if, just to take me as an example, I served with all of you folks. I decided, or perhaps the voters came to their senses and elected someone else, and then I was put on the commission, essentially deciding the salaries of people that I had served with and worked with. And that didn't seem to me to be sufficiently removed from, you know, actually sitting legislators doing the same thing. And that's why the language is written that way. But, you know, if the committee wanted to change that and wanted to put in some cooling off period, then that would be fine.
Any questions?
I think just a comment. First, I thank you for bringing this forward, and obviously it's timely, and it's, we should be looking at something like this. But I guess my comment is that I find many things in here that I would love to discuss and ask questions about. And I'm wondering about whether we should have any type of a group or something that would look at this and study this or something, a group or some kind of a sub, because there's lots of thoughtful ideas and open to discussion, and I it's a big bill. I don't know what the committee would committee here would think of.
The next committee referral is the Finance Committee. Reverend Dugan, would you like to have the person or to answer the question? Let's ask.
Kyle had a question,
Mr. Chairman.
You have another question?
I asked the.
Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't see you down there.
Question.
Speak up.
Reverend Dugan, to you. I'm just curious the relevance of the age statistics in the back of the packet. They're fascinating, but why are they in there? I'm just curious.
Thank you, Representative Johansson. I wanted to take a look at the composition of the legislature and the composition of the body politic, essentially, and see if what I suspected was true, which is that the level of compensation in the Alaska legislature skews the composition of that body compared to the population. And what you're going to find is a lot more people like me who are, should I put this, of an age, and a lot fewer people like you who are out there trying to raise families and make a living. There may be a lot of reasons for that, but certainly I think it's fair to think that one of them is that the compensation simply isn't sufficient for people who are trying to do those things, that old retired people like myself can afford to do this better than young people like yourself who have young children and all of the costs that are attendant on that. So it was just really an attempt to see. I thought that's the way it would work out. I decided to take a look at it and see if it did, and in fact it does. Alaskans in the 30 to 40 and 40 to 50 year old age ranges are substantially underrepresented in the Alaska legislature. And Alaskans in the 50 to 60 age range are substantially overrepresented compared to their numbers in the general population. You know, people can reach their own conclusions as to why that is. I think it would be difficult to imagine a reason for that happening that didn't include the compensation.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Johnson, do you have a question? Okay. Please stay here, and I'm going to ask, is...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If we might, I think Senator Elton is
yes.
here.
Senator Elton, come forward, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Kim Elton. I'm a senator from District B. I'm not here testifying in my capacity as senator. I mean, it may be hard for y'all to wrap your imaginations around this notion. I'm here more as an expert witness, and I think the reason the sponsor of the bill wanted me to testify is because I am a member or was a member of the last salary commission. We went through a process. We made recommendations. Just for a little bit of a historical perspective, in 1976, the voters kind of gave a thumping to the legislature by referendum repealing pay raises that they had given themselves and others. I think one of the things that happened wasn't just a pay raise, but was a very generous retirement system that was also included as part of the pay raise. And more than 4 out of 5 Alaskans who bothered to vote in 1976 told the legislature they had gone too far. As a result of that, a salary commission was created in law, and we were, I think there were 5 of us. The difference, I think, between that salary commission and what is being recommended to you, there are just a few differences. One is our charge was to look at the salaries not just of the legislature, the governor, the lieutenant governor, and the commissioners, but also to look at and make recommendations on salaries for deputy commissioners, division directors, sitting members of some of the commissions that we had back then, as well as judicial salaries. And we did that. We were under kind of a time constraint. We were supposed to be appointed at, I think, 1 month, and it was actually a month or two later that the appointments were made. They were gubernatorial appointments, as is recommended here. And we held hearings in 3 different communities across the state, Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. Just as an aside, I would note that all of this happened more than 30 years ago. I was very young at the time. More than 30 years ago. And so some of the things are somewhat difficult to dredge from memory. I do remember, however, and I remarked upon it at the time, that given the overwhelming voice of the electorate, one of the things that struck me about the public hearing process is most of the people that showed up were people whose salaries we were going to be adjusting or making recommendations about. One of the other things I think that may be slightly different in this bill, and Representative Dugan can correct me if I'm wrong, is it was kind of a take it or leave it package. The law provided that you couldn't cherry pick from the different recommendations. And you can do that in law, but of course the next legislature that's, you know, thinking about accepting it, you know, can change that law in the process of cherry picking. I think my reading of this bill provides that this would take it would not take a vote of the legislature unless they were prepared to reject the recommendations of the salary commission. So that's a different approach, and maybe a better approach given the what happened back then. For example, on legislative pay, we recommended a salary of $11,750, I think. We recommended a schedule for payment of that salary because I think the public members, and at the time I was a public member, all believed that one of the challenges for all you legislators who aren't lucky enough to live in beautiful Juneau is that the vast majority of your expenses are front-end loaded. I mean, you've got to leave your home someplace else, come down here, establish another home for a period of time. So we actually staggered the pay, making sure that most of the pay given to legislators happened in the first part of the year to help accommodate that. We also recommended that given the need for legislators to be in close contact with their constituents, we even provided as part of the compensation package a one-round trip airfare back to the district that the legislator could use or not use to meet with constituents. We also recommended some things that in retrospect I'm not so sure were good ideas, but for example, for every biannual term, if you were reelected, you got a $500 pay increase. Now, I'm not so sure that from the perspective of age and wisdom, I'm not so sure that was a good idea. But what happened is the legislature actually took the $11,750 component and did not take the rest. I will say just one more thing that may not be as big a problem under the structure envisioned in this bill. And that was, we spent a lot of time as members of the Salary Commission trying to figure out on parity issues, trying to figure out whether you start at the bottom and work up or you start at the top and work down. And what I mean is because the purview of the Salary Commission was broader than envisioned in this bill, we wanted to make sure that you know, the governor made more than a commissioner, the commissioner made more than deputy commissioners made more than directors, and directors made more than the people that they supervised. And the other side of that, of course, is working up from the bottom, make sure that directors made more than the people they supervised and then going up. That was a difficult challenge, one that I think is mostly avoided in this structure because, again, Representative Dugan can correct me if I'm wrong, his commission envisions elected officials and the chief executives of each of the agencies, which I assume is limited to the commissioners. So that may not be a challenge. I'll just wrap up my testimony and hopefully be able to answer any questions from the depth of memory if you have them by saying, you know, that was a long time ago, and I think it is interesting to note, for example, that the Salary Commission recommendation for a commissioner's salary was $47,000. And I think that gets exactly to the issue that this was 31 years ago. but I think the problem that actually prompted that Salary Commission informs this bill, and it is certainly perhaps a better alternative than asking legislators to do what they did in 1975, which is to set their own salary. And this is not an uncommon approach. I know that some of the basic research that I did a couple of months ago, not for this bill, this is kind of an approach that's being used in Washington State. They have a salary commission that makes recommendations, and it's an ongoing salary commission. With that, I'll stop. I mean, there's a tactic in my mind. Do I keep talking so you don't have time to ask questions that I might not be able to answer? But with that, I'll stop, Mr. Chair, and try to answer any questions you may
have. Thank you. Representative Johansson, I believe, has a question or comment.
Could you please expound on your feelings about the current administration of the Alaska Marine Highway?
Mr. Chair, how much time do we have?
We have a 4 seconds. Okay. And I think we need to start going there.
And I would do that in the capacity of case senator.
Bad.
Oh, dear.
Representative Roses.
I didn't know if he was finished or
not. Representative Roses, I'm finished with the question.
I thought maybe that was just the lead into a real question. Back 30 years ago when this commission existed, did that require confirmation of the legislature, or was it strictly appointed by the governor?
Strictly appointed by the governor, which kind of made it makes kind of sense. I mean, you heard the sponsor of the bill talk earlier. I mean, I think the purpose was to try and separate the legislature as far as possible from any of the product that might be presented back to them.
Representative Dahl, then Representative Coghill.
What led to its demise? What did you say?
It's an interesting question, and I'll try to answer it through the chair. I'm Representative Dahl. I will note that I was initially appointed and I went through the whole process for the first recommendation. I then went commercial fishing out of Elfin Cove and resigned before the second round from the commission, before the second round began, because I couldn't do both. I couldn't fly in from Elfin Cove and fly off to Fairbanks in the middle of the trolling season. So with that perspective and with that knowledge, there may be better people to ask. However, I think one of the things that became problematic was the notion that salary commission would present something, and it was kind of an all or nothing. I think it just kind of became difficult. And that could partly be because it was all or nothing, and partly because of the broad scope of the commission. This is much narrower, and focuses much. It doesn't have anything to do with judiciary or all the commissions or directors, and so I suspect that those things had a role in it.
Paula? Okay. Representative Coghill.
Well, clarifying that you didn't go the second round might help, but it seems to me that the recommendations then came to the legislature and were changed pretty dramatically directly after that by another set of legislators, and that kind of set in motion a system that we have in now. So I guess the question is, if we go through a commission process and it doesn't land somewhere squarely in what the public might expect, or that the pressure on the legislators from the public might expect, then we'll end up with the same result. And so can you tell me what the discussion was from your perspective back then on how you would fit what the public expectation was against what a reasonable compensation package expectation was?
I will try, Representative. I want to stress that, you know, I consider myself still a fairly young person, but this was a long time ago.
You are compared to me.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think there was an awful lot of angst that the commission's recommendation caused in the public. I mean, my recollection is that I think the public accepted the fact that this was a fairer process, and that the people who were getting the raises weren't setting the raises. I think the angst was more within this building, and not with the public. I don't remember, for example, during testimony or even during testimony to the legislature, I don't remember a lot of Alaskans coming forward and saying, well, they made a mistake. Certainly this shouldn't be the raise. I think there was an acceptance by the public that having a separate group, a non-involved group, set the wages was a fairly fair process. But I do remember a lot of discussion inside this building of people unhappy with the recommendations. Or, for example, I'll go back to the one thing I mentioned earlier, the one round trip airfare. That kind of devolved into a discussion, why just one? Or it devolved into a discussion of, well, you know, are my constituents going to, you know, think that, you know, we're adding another perk to the compensation package that we have now? So it was mostly within the building and not outside the building. I will commit to you,
I'll
Representative.
Do some research, but I'll take your word at that.
And one of the other people that the committee might want to talk to, or the committee members might want to call, is a colleague of mine on the commission that was elected the chair of the commission, and that's Kay Diebels, who at the time was a City Borough of Juneau Assemblywoman. maybe she had just retired, but a very dedicated public servant, and she was a chair, and you might also want to expand the conversation to her with that kind of a question.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
And I'd like to call on Mr. Carl Kurtz from NCSL. Are you online, sir? Mr. Kurtz?
Calling Carl.
It appears that he's online but not coming through. While we're trying to figure that out, we have Nikki Neal. Are you in the audience, sir? Yeah. Would you like to come up and make any comments at this point, and while we try to resolve the communications problem?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Nikki Neal, Director of the Division of Personnel for the Department of Administration, and I'm actually here to answer any questions you may have of us. The department at this time doesn't have an opinion on the bill. We did prepare a fiscal note. One thing I would like to offer is that in preparing the fiscal note, we accounted for the cost of conducting the meetings and associated travel expenses. We did not account for if a formal salary survey was necessary. We have the means within our existing staff to, for example, survey other states, but if there was something more comprehensive necessary, there would be a cost for conducting that as we would contract that out.
Thank you. Any questions? Not. Thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe
Representative Coghill.
Just since I have both the sponsor and this young lady here, has it been contemplated that there might be a contractor engaged in this? Is there, for example, give me the scope of what's available out there for us to get that kind of professional input?
Certainly there are contractors available to conduct these sorts of studies. What the Division of Personnel has the capability to do at this time is we have a process as a result of a membership we have in the National Association of State Personnel Executives organization, and we have a method for surveying rather quickly and efficiently other states. So that would be something that we could do with our existing staff. The way I read the bill, it would be up to the committee if they wanted us to go out and do something more extensive. Okay. It would be at their direction.
Thank you, Representative Coghill, through the chair. One of the reasons for reducing the scope of the people who are covered under this bill as opposed to the last salary commission was to reduce the complexity of the task in front of the salary commission, and hopefully essentially, I mean, to put it in plain language, I tried to take what I consider to be the politically sensitive salaries and limit it to that so that we wouldn't have the necessity of going through any expensive salary studies or anything like that, because we're not going far enough down in the pecking order or broadly enough in terms of numbers to require that in all probability. At least that was my thinking.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with him on the complexity, because once you get into those bargaining unit areas, it can get really complex. And so this is more in the discretionary set. So I appreciate that. But it also wanders into another area, Mr. Chairman, and that is almost every area of professional service right now, people are trying to figure out how to attract other people. And so not only does the commissioner, the legislature, even much in the judicial branch, compete for other professionals, the salary issue is probably one large component of that. So everybody's competing for a smaller workforce right now. And so the demographics of the legislature being what they are may not necessarily be just a portion, because of the compensation, but it definitely plays a part in it. There's no doubt in my mind about it. But I just for what it's worth, we're wandering into that area, and I need to ponder the structure of this over against all of those who are pretty much doing the same thing in other professional areas.
Representative,
Mr. Chairman, if I might, when I was thinking about how to put this bill together, it seemed to me that, you know, frankly, for these positions, I never really saw the salary as attracting people to this. I don't think people run for the legislature because they're going to get rich or that they become commissioners because they can't make more money someplace else. My intent is something slightly different, which is to keep the compensation from being a barrier for people who would otherwise serve, so that somebody who might want to offer themselves to the voters for whatever reason they might have could do that even if they were young and had a family. So it's not really a recruitment and retention issue to me so much as not just erecting a complete barrier to people who would otherwise at least attempt to do it, what it is we're doing.
And, Mr. Chairman, I agree with that because the commission is going to be tasked to look at equitable rate. And so the word equitable is going to become a huge issue when they have to settle down on what that is. And I think this public record is going to help them with some direction on that, because otherwise they have to look at what would probably could be termed competitive rates rather than equitable rates.
Yeah. If I might, Mr. Chairman, I frankly don't ever see us paying as much to bid the CEO of – you know, of one of the native corporations away from his or her job, for instance. But like I say, at some point, for some people who would otherwise be willing to do this and other jobs that are covered, compensation becomes a barrier. And it's my hope, you know, I mean, frankly, the commission's going to decide this. I'm not. But it's my hope that we're going to be able to come to a compensation structure that at least removes that barrier to public service.
Okay. Now, we had a couple of questions from the committee, but we have Mr. Kurtz online, I think, from NCSL. So before I lose that communication link, I'm going to ask to delay the questions in the committee. Mr. Kurtz, are you now available?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to Alaska by our phone system up here. Please identify yourself and tell us about the bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and Representative Dugan. I'd actually rather be there by myself rather than via phone, and partly because I know several of you personally and would like to be able to greet you, and also because I just checked the weather and I discovered that it's about 20 degrees warmer in Juneau than it is in Denver.
Well, I guess so. No, we're not going to have this. We're not going to be hearing this bell during fishing season, so you might as well testify now.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I want to offer some perspectives on how legislators are compensated around the country to help give you some background for this bill. And I'm going to be talking about two things, really. First of all, what legislators are paid around the country compared to Alaska. And secondly, what methods are used to set their compensation. So to start, and I think all of you have a handout that is labeled Perspectives on Legislative Compensation. Do you have that before you?
Yes, we do.
Okay. What I try to do is... In a lot of states, it's very confusing trying to figure out what legislators are actually paid. Extreme cases, they may be paid only $5 a day in salary, but they get a whole lot of other payments that the IRS would count as compensation. And so I try to do my best to give an estimate of what an average legislator in each state earns from legislative service. And in order to do that, I combine salary, any taxable per diem payments, and any other unvouchered expense payments that members could keep for themselves if they wanted to. I don't make any effort. In a lot of states, they give the speaker or the Senate president, the majority leaders or committee chairs additional compensation. I don't look at that. I try to take the average rank and file legislator. So if you go to the map that is labeled Estimated Annual Compensation 2007, I've grouped the states into several categories. The first category in the darkest color there are those that are paid more than $60,000 a year. And what I often say about this is that it's a salary on which you could make a living and might not have to supplement it through other sources of income. The states that are in this category, for the most part, are the largest population states in which the legislatures are generally, the members are pretty much full-time as legislators. So California and Illinois, Michigan, Pennsylvania, New York, and so on. And then the next category are ones where the pay is between about $45,000 and $60,000. And there we see some other fairly large Midwestern and Eastern states like Ohio and Wisconsin and New Jersey. You also have Missouri, Oklahoma, and Washington State in that category. Then occupying kind of the middle ground here is the $30,000 to $45,000 range, which prevails pretty much in the southeastern, among the southeastern states. As on a lot of things, the southeastern states tend to copy each other on a regional basis more than almost any other region does, and there seems to be kind of a standard view in those states that their compensation ought to be about $35,000 to $40,000. Then, and I include Alaska in that category, and actually my estimate of average compensation for an Alaska legislator is about $33,000. And I arrive at that by taking your $24,000 in salary, and then I obtained from your legislative service agency the average amount of per diem, interim per diem payments. I think you call them long-term per diem, among all 60 members. And that average was about $9,000. Now, recognize that's an average. There are a number of you who don't claim any interim payments, and there are others who claim substantially more. So that's how I get Alaska in that kind of pink category on the map. Then the $15,000 to $30,000 category includes a couple of surprises in that there are some big states there, Texas and Georgia. Texas in particular has the salaries embedded in the state constitution, and they've had great difficulty changing that. And then finally, the last category is less than $15,000. And for the most part, this is kind of the Rocky Mountain West and North and South Dakota. The extreme here that many of you probably know about is New Hampshire, where the members are paid a grand total of $100 a year. They don't get anything else, any per diem or anything other than mileage on their cars. So essentially serving in the New Hampshire legislature is a volunteer job completely. So let me move then to the next slide, which is labeled red, white, and blue legislatures. And what, the reason I introduced this is to try to make a little bit of sense of all the variation in the compensation levels. And this slide shows what I call the red, white, and blue legislatures. Because the legislatures vary in the degree of what political scientists call professionalization. But in the legislative world, we usually call full-time versus part-time legislatures. The ones that are in red are the ones that are virtually full-time. They're reasonably well-paid, and they have quite large staffs. And once again, this is mostly our largest population states. At the opposite extreme are the states in blue. These are the classic citizen legislatures where they're typically meeting only 2 or 3 months out of the year. Their pay is very low and they have very small staffs. I should have said there are about 10 states in the red category. There are about 15 or 16 states in the blue category, and then the remaining states, almost half of them, are some mix in the white category that I've labeled hybrid here, and I would include the Alaska legislature in that category. Now, the relevance of this appears on the next slide, which is labeled compensation of legislators, and what I've done is to break the average the compensation in these three categories. And so you can, and I've included Congress here just for fun. And you can see here in the red states, the most professionalized legislatures, the average pay today is about $75,000 a year. The average in the blue states, the classic citizen legislatures, is less than $20,000 a year. And the average in the white states is just a little bit less than $40,000. And so Alaska is slightly below the average in that white category. And on this slide, it appears as if there have been significant increases from 1972 to 2007. That 1972 is not chosen randomly, by the way. It's the year that I came to work for NCSL, and I first started calculating these numbers. So I guess we could choose any other number, but that's the one that suited me. But if you turn over then to the next slide that's labeled real compensation, what I've done here is to translate the 1972 dollars into 2007 terms so that we're dealing with constant dollars over time. And what you can see here is that in most categories, there's been virtually no change in real terms in the amount of compensation given to legislators over this 35-year period of time. And in the Congress has suffered a significant decline in the value of their salary against inflation, and as have you in Alaska as well. I might say that for the Alaska calculation, in 1972, the salary was about $9,000 a year, and then I did, as I explained earlier, I added in an estimate of the a very rough estimate of the interim compensation that legislators used during that period. So that's kind of the general picture of levels of compensation across the country. When you go to the next slide, I turn to my second topic, which is the methods that are used to pay legislators or to determine their level of compensation. And this slide is actually coded by color so that the darker the color, the more the legislature has to be proactive in order to change their their compensation. So that the great bulk of the states are in the darkest kind of brown color here, and they are states that either don't have a commission at all, or if they have a commission, like Alaska has one on the books, it's inactive. That's well over half the states. I think about 30 of the states fall in that category. The second category are the states where the commission, there is a commission, but it only makes recommendations which can either be accepted or rejected either by the legislature or maybe some other entity, but usually the legislature. And the states in that category would be Connecticut, Maine, Minnesota, Virginia, and West Virginia. Then the third category are the ones that are like the bill that Representative Dugan has introduced, as I understand it, in which the commission actions take effect unless they are rejected by, and it varies from state to state, it could be the legislature, sometimes the governor has a role in it, and in one case, kind of a unique case, Arizona, the recommendations of the commission go to a vote of the people, and the question before the people is, shall the recommendations of the state compensation commission be accepted, yes or no? So in some ways, I could have put Arizona in the kind of makes recommendations only category, but because the legislature didn't have anything to do with it, I put it in this middle category. Then the fourth category is in the kind of very pale tan here, have tied their salaries automatically to some kind of an index in the state. And that could be a particular category of state workers, or it might be a cost of living index or some other economic index. The states that are in this category are, interestingly, with one exception, they're generally large population states, Florida, Illinois, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and then, interestingly, Montana is also in this category. And then lastly, there is the rather unique case of Washington State, where the commission has the complete power to set, to determine the compensation for, I believe it's the governor, the cabinet officers, and the legislature. And by state constitution, the only way to overturn the Washington Commission's recommendations is through a citizen-initiated referendum. And in the course of 20-some years that this commission has been in existence, that has never happened. So just to say a few more words about the Washington Commission, it's made up of 16 members. Nine of them are randomly drawn from the list of registered voters, nine being the number of congressional districts, so that there's one randomly selected public member from each congressional district. And then there are seven other members selected from five specific professions that are set forth in the law, and those seven members are selected by the House Speaker and the Senate President.
Thank you very much. We're going to have to, we have floor session here in just a few minutes, so we need, if you can, make a summary here.
Okay. Well, that really wraps up what I had to say, and I'm first of all, glad to answer any questions, and second of all, if you run out of time and you want to call me or ask, send me any further questions, I'll be glad to respond to them offline.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Kurtz? And a couple other questions earlier, and I think Representative Rose wants to speak, maybe offer an amendment or
then
somebody.
Johansson was first, and then.
Yeah, Representative Johansson.
Okay. Thank you. First, I appreciate you bringing this forward. You know, when it's in our hands, it basically ties our hands, and I think this is a positive step to really look at what the compensation is and get it out of our hands, so I appreciate you bringing it forward. Just a couple things. You mentioned that we would only be able to basically say no to what, as a legislature. And I'm sure this comes out through the public process, but, you know, some states, looking at the information, don't have, for example, per diem. Or they just get a straight salary, no travel stuff, anything like that. That would affect people that work across the street. I don't know how that plays into it. But how do issues like that, Department of Administration is going to have staff there, how do you see issues that, you know, are outside of strictly an up-and-down number, or it would affect state employees, or it would affect some other portion that we would have to take action on through the budget? How do those conversations in your mind take place? Would that be through the public process?
Thank you, Representative Johansson. Through the chair. The reason it's a compensation commission as opposed to a salary commission is that it recognizes the fact that there are other elements to compensation besides what is strictly called salary. As I said, I'm trying not to be too prescriptive in terms of what the commission would do, but when I think about it, what I think about is the commission taking a look at all elements of the compensation package for the people who are listed here. Inevitably, I think there'll be some comparisons to other people. You know, you'd say, for instance, somebody would say, well, should a legislator make as much as a division director or a deputy director? I mean, something of that nature. But the real impact is on a fairly narrowly drawn set of players here, us, the commissioners, the governor, and the lieutenant governor, so that we don't get into the kinds of things that Senator Elton was talking about trying to figure out, do you start from the bottom up or work from the top line down. So I think that while there might be comparisons to other compensation packages, doesn't seem to me that there would be any direct effect on those from what the commission might do.
Thank you. Representative Roses.
Actually, I wanted to offer an amendment. This would be on page 3, line 18.
Page 3, line 18.
And I actually put it in writing for the reporter. And that would be to insert, after the words "may not have served," insert the following words: in the 4 years prior to their appointment in an office or position for which the commission shall submit a recommendation.
I hate to see us eliminate the possibility of having anybody that served in public office, either at a state or municipal level, be excluded from this commission. Had we done that, the commission 30 years ago would have been absent some of the members that they had. As Senator Elton testified, one of the persons with whom he served had just stepped out as in a municipal position, so they would have not, under this provision, been allowed to serve. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to eliminate the possibility of having some institutional history serve on this commission.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to object only for a couple of small reasons. One, I have not considered the bill in total enough to really follow, although I tend to agree with how we do some limitations, but I haven't really sat down and studied out these limitations. So I would only ask the maker of the amendment to give us time, get it in writing. Let me take a look at it. I appreciate that particular part, but there might be more to it than what I see just specifically on the surface here. I haven't had a time to really dig into this thing yet. And so that would be my only reluctance at this point. I'd like to see it in writing. I'd like to see the context. And I just don't have it just yet.
Representative Johansson, then Johnson.
Yeah, just on the amendment, you know, it popped up in my head when you mentioned that. You know, we have a candidate now who has filed for office who's a former legislator, who's been out of the legislature for, I don't know, four or five years out of Kodiak. It's just something to think about. You know, if you have somebody who's been a legislator, has been out for 4 years, and files the next year, just, you know, something that, you know, I think we need time to kind of think about those things. And you could say he's been out 4 years and he gets on the commission and pushes for a change and then files the next year, you know. So, you know, that doesn't look good just in appearances. So I think we need a little time to kind of work those things out a little bit.
Okay, Reverend Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my question is, what are your intentions for this? Are you intending to try to move this today, or are we wanting to?
Well, I'd hope to move it today, but now we have an amendment that somebody wants to discuss, and I believe you had some other concerns. It's a wish of the committee. If we need to hold it until Saturday, I'll be happy to go along with that.
Then I'll hold my questions until then, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Chairman, and I would object to moving it today, may even object to moving it Saturday, because there are some bigger questions we need to add that are ancillary to this. For example, the question that was brought up by the NCSO testifier, are we going to contemplate a full-time legislator or not? And, and maybe look at the history of where we're at now compared to where this commission might anticipate us being. And then if we're going to look at what is expected of a legislator, then we probably should even think out loud about what we'd anticipate that staffing level should be. So it raises a lot of questions in my mind right off the bat.
Okay. Quickly, Reverend.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just two quick points. I don't believe that the current language would preclude even a city and municipal official from serving on the commission, because their salaries aren't affected by, because it's a limited scope in terms of whose salaries are affected.
Okay. With that, I'm going to hold this bill as we did the other one, and we have an amendment on the table. We have an objection to the amendment, and we can debate that amendment when we come back.
Fine, thank you.
Our next scheduled meeting is Saturday. We're trying to move bills with all deliberate speed, and that will require to do some work on Saturday. And on Saturday, we will be hearing again the HB 281, which is the APOC reporting bill. We may be able to work on this bill again, and we also have on the schedule HB 296, extending the board of parole, and HB 269, requiring their flags purchased by the state of Alaska be manufactured in the United States of America. And so I want to continue these good discussions. And with that, I want to thank the committee for a very good first session.
So, Mr.
Any other comments before we adjourn?
Just Mr. Chairman. So my expectation then is the next time we bring up this bill on compensation 260, that amendment is the first thing we'll discuss.
I would think so, yes.
All right. Okay, just good. I'll be more prepared for that amendment. Thank you.
Any other comments? Thank you very much for attending, everybody.